Call the Environmental Natural Resource Committee to order. The date is January 20th, 2011. Good afternoon, committee members. We have just a couple things on the agenda. We're going to be finishing up with a presentation from the DNR. Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer is here, and he will take us through the. He is saying about an hour, and in the last half hour, we'll deal with the first bill that's coming forward from Senator Carlson. So, Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Hopefully, it doesn't take me an hour, but we aren't going to go as fast as I tried to go the last time we were here. We have a little bit more time, I think. So, what we have left to do, and does everybody have a copy of the presentation that we started? I guess it would have been last Tuesday. We have more copies if you don't have your copy in front of you. We left off on the Division of Fish and Wildlife. Unfortunately, Acting Director Ed Bogus is working on some other issues right now, so I'm just going to do the Division of Fish and Wildlife presentation for you all. You'll have plenty of time and opportunity to meet with Ed Bogus as we talk about fish and wildlife and other game and fish-related issues. Then we're going to talk about forestry, lands and minerals, and parks and trails. And then, as Chairman said, talk about the land sales bill from 2010.
Excuse me, Commissioner. I should recognize there is a quorum present at this time. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Members, the Division of Fish and Wildlife works with the people of Minnesota to conserve and manage habitat, manage the fish and wildlife populations, providing angling and hunting opportunities, and to help preserve Minnesota's fishing and hunting and trapping heritage. Chapters that they oversee are 86A, 97A, B, and C, which are game and fish, hunting and fishing, which we will have the opportunity, I'm sure, to spend a lot of time talking about in the coming weeks and months. You can see the budget that's laid out here. It's $216 or $217 million almost, with 64% roughly coming from the Game of Fish Fund, or $138 million. The general fund portion of the Game and Fish Division is mostly for treaty payments, which is, this is a biennial number, $15.3 million. The actual amount of general fund that is within this division is about $200,000 right now. So most, if not all, for all practical purposes, of the budget of the Fish and Wildlife Division comes from hunters and anglers, large portion over the past biennium. You can see 15.2%, $32.9 million has come from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Some Clean Water Fund money, $1.2 million. That special revenue funds are like timber off of wildlife management areas and things of those types of nature. And 10.8, federal funding, the Pittman-Robertson Wallet Pro dollars of 8.2. The Environmental Trust Fund that comes from the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources at $2.5 million. And then the general fund that's there right now, it's 1.5. Actually, it's gone down or will be going down again. You can see the strategic objectives are for fish and wildlife population management, fish and wildlife habitat management, and then working with the citizens, outreach, education, and assistance. Some of the supporting programs that are within this division are lake and stream assessment and surveys, information systems, monitoring, fisheries permitting, population research, treaty coordination, fish culture and stocking, the fish wild health and pathology lab, our wildlife health activities, capture and release programs, dealing with wildlife depredation, which is important in a lot of the outstate portions, and fish and wildlife season management and regulation. What's the goal of this is for these healthy and productive fish and wildlife populations to be maintained on a sustainable basis and support the high quality and abundant fishing, trapping, and wildlife recreation viewing opportunities that the citizens of the state expect, and they really tell us that that's what they want. So we do all we can to meet their expectations. Our walleye stocking that we've done over the past several years has exceeded the work that we've done in the past. That program has really ramped up. But also working with the stakeholders to make sure that we're providing sustainable populations as much as possible through habitat management. On the fishery side of things, conserving and restoring fish and wildlife habitat, providing access in the recreational opportunities is really important. Aquatic habitat, shallow lakes and moist soil units, this is to provide that duck habitat, nesting habitat. Aquatic plant management, habitat acquisitions, our Stream Lake Wildlife Area Habitat Improvements, the research and assessment that goes along with that, and then the CBI. We'll talk about this when we talk about clean water funding as well, but Clean Water Index of Biological Diversity, it's a way that we can assess a waterway to make sure it is providing for that healthy water supply source for the fisheries and also the other birds and mammals that are dependent upon it. Some of our outreach programs you can see here, technical guidance, private landowner assistance, our MinAqua program, which is it's kind of a train-the-trainer program for schools. We provide education and assistance for aquatic management opportunities and angling within the schools. Southeast Asian program, this has really been a successful opportunity for us, and outreach and also education, making sure people understand the rules and regulations and the culture of our fishing that's so important to us. Recruitment and retention, which is just the key to our sustainable way of life in northern Minnesota, making sure people are going up there and hunting and fishing and people have the opportunity to hunt and fish all throughout the state. Customer market research, education workshops, environmental review and permitting. We do some of those activities with the Fish and Wildlife Division, looking at populations at CBI, or that biological index is part of that activity. Public information and the licensing and recreation of vehicle registrations are run out of the Fish and Wildlife Division. So our what's called the ELS, or electronic licensing system, is actually office within the Division of Fish and Wildlife. If you come over to our offices there, right as soon as you come in the front door is our licensing division, where you can register your boat, snowmobile, ATV, buy a hunting, fishing license, things of that nature. So those activities are coordinated out of the Fish and Wildlife Division. A few of the priority outcomes and measures out, we already talked about this a little bit, but the lake and stream survey and assessment activities that go on, these are critical to fisheries management, making sure that we have the information on populations that are there so we know what's in the lakes and streams, what may be causing population explosions or in many cases declines, and making informed decisions. We have developed 358 lake and stream management plans that we monitor and update. And we've conducted, most recently, 609 lake surveys, doing winter temperature oxygen surveys on 394 lakes, 124 stream surveys, 6 creel surveys, and 8 management planning evaluations on lakes. And you can see here, we've also completed 200 IBI lake surveys annually, making sure that we are keeping an eye on what's going on those water bodies. Another key priority that we work on is, I think some of you know, Representative Scoy knows, particularly the work that we've done over the past years on bovine tuberculosis, making sure that we're targeting the needed animals for surveillance of our deer herd, making sure that we are proving and continuing to prove that that herd is TB-free, which is so important to maintaining a viable cattle stock resource within the state of Minnesota. So we worked very hard. It was a lot of painful work for some of us. I mean, we had to reduce the deer herd in northwestern Minnesota to a very low level to make sure that we could prove that TB wasn't there. The past couple of years, we've been very successful. We've worked with the residents up there. They've been supportive of us, and I think the outcome now is going to get us off of the federal program and get us back to where we need to be. We're going to continue this.
Deputy Commissioner, would you talk about that split of the state, and maybe Senator Scoy can jump in as well, however, where that to the members that understand that cattle distinction that we dealt with the TB bovine?
Mr. Chair, it might be Senator Scoy probably has more complete picture than I would have on it. So,
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Minnesota is split into two zones for cattle sales and herd management. There's I don't know if it's called a quarantine zone, probably not that anymore, but there is it's a smaller area up in the northwest corner of the state where the bovine TB was, and those cattle producers are required to do annual testing of all their animals. They have to do significant paperwork trails before they move cattle, and that's the area that the Deputy Commissioner Myers was talking about, where we did an extensive white-tailed deer depopulation effort. It was quite, I think Bob said it right, quite painful to do at the time, but being as how this year, for the first time in 6 years, we didn't have any positives in the wild deer herd, hopefully it looks like it's going to pay off. But there is a small area up there that has different requirements for cattle movement. I think Dr. Hartman indicated that sometime by the fall of 2012, if we don't have any more positives, that area will go back to being bovine TB free.
Thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, this just outlines how important it is for us to be monitoring these wildlife populations for any diseases. We will be coming back and talking about bovine TB and CWD in the future, but maintaining populations that we can survey after they've been harvested. We worked very, very closely. The Deer Hunters Association, I really want to commend their activities to work with us this past deer hunting season, providing some incentives for people to bring in their deer to be tested. We test the lymph nodes, and then we send those out to be examined. They gave away a couple rifles and, I think, a chance at a lifetime deer license if people came in and registered their deer so we could get those lymph nodes out. And it was just a great private-public partnership that we have. And it's the financial impacts of bovine TB is something that's very important to us. We want to make sure we're doing all we can at the Division of Fish and Wildlife and the Department to help our fellow cattle producers. That moves us on to the Division of Forestry, Mr. Chair. And as we've done in the past, I do have Director Epperly here. I'll bring him up and introduce him to the committee and have him walk through this brief outline for the Division of Forestry.
Mr. Chair.
One second. Senator Gazalka has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I just had a question about your perspective on the wolves population in Minnesota. Not the Timberwolves, or not the basketball team, but so just where you're at on that issue. I realize it's federal, but I'm just curious what your perspective is.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazalka, I was hoping we could save that for when we hear the bill, actually, that was recently introduced. But we have been urging the federal government to delist the wolf in Minnesota for some time now. So I think when we do have the hearing on that bill, we'll have a great discussion of it. There is strong support, especially from Senator Amy Klobuchar, at the federal level to help us with the federal Fish and Wildlife agencies and whoever else we need to deal with to get that delisting done. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Myers, to that point, the state had a management plan a number of years. What's the status of your wolf management plan? Is there a plan that you would be following, or would you have to develop a new plan if the feds were to delist wolves?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Squay, we may need to update it a little bit, but that won't take us very long. The thing, and I think the bill addresses that, is the five-year waiting period once the federal government delists the wolf. We will be ready to go whenever we can get over those barriers that are there. It won't take us long to revamp or update that plan.
Thank you.
Mr. Epperly.
Thank you, Mr. Welcome. Chair. Dave Epperly, Director of Forestry for the Minnesota DNR. I'm going to do the same. I'll give you a quick overview of the division, including our statutory authorities, funding, supporting programs, some priority outcomes, and some thoughts on strategies. And before I do that, I just wanted to make note that the Minnesota DNR and the Division of Forestry is celebrating 100 years of conservation and forest management in the state this year, 2011. And we have published a book, which is a really good chronicle of the history going all the way back to the Hinckley fires in the 1800s, and is quite an interesting book of some of the issues and concerns that we've been dealing with in the state for the last 100 years. So I just wanted to mention that. It's kind of an important year. The Division of Forestry protects and manages the trees and woodlands and forests for the benefit of the people of Minnesota. And we do that by providing and sharing expertise to help us understand and sustain these forests. We'll provide a sustainable supply of multiple forest resources. We protect lives and property from wildfire, and we fulfill our responsibilities to the Permanent School Trust. Our statutory authorities range from 86A, which is the outdoor recreation, Chapter 88, which we call the wildfire statute, which basically talks about wildfire and open burning regulations, state forest tree planning, Chapter 89, Sustainable Forest Resources, 89A. That gives the formation of the Forest Resource Council, which you heard us talk about earlier this week. Chapter 90 is our timberland statutes, which lay out our timber regulations and statutes. And Chapter 290C outlines our authorities related to sustainable forest management of public and private lands. Our funding sources for the fiscal year of 10 and 11 total $170 million. And right off the bat, that's a little bit high from what we normally have. Typically, our biennial budget is between $135 and $140 million. The reason why it's $170 million has a lot to do with some one-time funding, which is related to the acquisition of easements. That was $36 million from the Lessard-Sams money. And in addition to that, there was some one-time funding from the Federal Forest Legacy. Both of those are one-time funding. So it makes it makes our budget seem a little bit high. Typically, again, it's between $135 million and $140 million for the biennium. Breaking it down into categories, fire management is roughly, in this biennium, about $46 million. State forest management is about $48 million. That's a combination of general fund, natural resource fund, and general game and fish. Cooperative forest management is also a combination of, again, as I mentioned, the one-time funding of Lessard-Sams, the $36 million for the purchase of the easement, $7 million of one-time federal forest legacy funds. It's a combination of Lessard-Sams money, federal sources, and some general fund. Our core support programs, total about $25 million. General fund, forest management investment account, or which is the natural resource fund, predominant funding sources for those programs, and the Sustainable Forest Resource Act implementation, which is predominantly general fund money, is typically around $1.8 million with, in this biennium, one-time amount of about $700,000. So 42% of our total $170 million of funding in this biennium is from the general fund. Fire activities account for 22% of that alone. The remainder of the general fund dollars are spent on some of our core support programs, as I mentioned, and cooperative forest management. Outlining some of the support programs that go along with fire management, they're predominantly fire preparedness, fire prevention, and fire suppression. Again, funding level of, in this biennium, $46 million or 27%. Going through state forest land management, some of the supporting programs are timber management, silviculture and roads, forest inventory and assessment, forest certification, ecological classification system and development and application, and forest management planning. The funding level for that, for this biennium, is about $48 million for those programs, or about 28%. Cooperative forest management supports the effort of family forest owners and community forestry resources. Those supporting programs are family forest management, urban and community forest, and forest legacy. Again, it's $49 million, or about 29% of this biennium's budget, but that includes the one-time forest legacy dollars of $36 million from Lessard-Sams and a $7 million one-time amount from the federal forest legacy program. Going on to our core support programs, these are programs such as forest health, our forest nurseries, utilization and marketing, biomass utilization and development, information education, information systems, land asset management, and Minnesota Forest Resource Council timber harvest guidelines and monitoring. funding level there for those programs total about $25 million, or about 15% of the total biennial budget. The Sustainable Forest Resource Act, again, you heard about the Minnesota Forest Resource Council on Tuesday. These supporting programs include our site-level guideline monitoring programs, landscape plan implementation, policy development, and operations and research. And in this biennium, it totaled about $2.5 million, but that $2.5 million included a one-time amount of $700,000 for this biennium, or about 1% of our budget. Some of our priority outcomes and measures that are very important are making sure that we have a predictable and sustainable supply of quality wood from DNR-administered forest lands, which supports the Minnesota forest products industry and economy. One of the targets that we use to measure that would be to offer at least 800,000 cords of wood annually for sale throughout each fiscal year. And the importance of these are to continue to promote the sustainable management of DNR-administered lands. It promotes healthier and more resilient forests, and it also means that our forests are less susceptible to wildfire and are maintained and enhances wildlife habitat. And it's a continued protection of a clean water supply from our forest lands. In addition, the work that we do from Minnesota Forest state lands and others supports a primary forest product industry job level of about 40,000 jobs. So it's pretty broad, pretty important. Some of our strategies that we have, and following with our priority outcomes, we have a commitment to maintaining a strong forest-based economy to benefit the forest industries. And just as important, we can improve the health of our forests in an economical way, maintain wildlife habitat, and reduce potential wildfire. All that helps us prevent and maintain our costs. By pursuing some of our natural heritage funding, we can better understand our forest ecosystems through our ECS program, helps us make better decisions related to and improving our management techniques as we manage state forest land resources on state-administered lands. We continue to look for alternative funding sources to maintain or expand our budget. One of the messages I want to leave you with, that in the past we were significantly dependent on the general fund. We have moved away from general fund dependency from 80 to 85% of our being general fund funded to less than half, or about 42% general fund. This has helped us be flexible and maintain a hands-on approach to our management, the general fund helps us have that flexibility to maintain the flexibility to maintain this hands-on approach, which we often need to have in the management of our forests. An example of that would be this year we have deep snow conditions, which are causing problems for loggers, which are also causing problems for us in the woods and our productivity. It's difficult to get around. It takes more time to set up the timber. So having that flexibility is pretty important.
Mr. Epper, I have a question with regards to your one scale here. When you look back at 2002, you were at 1 million cord, and you're projecting out 2011, 12, and 13 at 800,000 cord. What's the dollar significance there? What's the difference between 800 and 100, or excuse me, 1 million cord? You may have mentioned that, but I.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. It's a little bit more complicated than a simple answer of giving you a dollar estimate, but what that really is that million cords had also included reoffered wood. When I started with the division in 2005, We had a flamboyant housing industry. We had high-priced stumpage. It averaged about $50 a cord. Over the last few years, the housing industry went into serious decline. Stumpage prices dropped from an average of $50 a cord to below $20 a cord. So we are trying to also manage the land. And so by maintaining an 800,000 cord level is a sustainable level that we can manage, but the difference in price from what it was and what it is today is extremely significant in what we were able to generate. And I would put it in the neighborhood over, compared to previous bienniums, of about $11 to $12 million is the difference of what it was worth then versus now.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just on that note, this is a bottom line. I mean, 800,000 is the minimum. We need to put up whatever we can. And Director Epperly talked about the reoffer wood as soon as we can back on the market if it's not purchased by sale. We strive for a million cords a year wherever possible, but dealing with the budgetary constraints we have, we're 800,000 is the bottom level. Hopefully we can get a lot more than that put up. Because we are one of the only games in town when people are looking for wood, as private landowners aren't putting their wood up because of the market industry, and the federal government isn't putting up as much wood as we would like to see as well. So we understand that we need to keep that natural resource economic engine going in northern Minnesota, not only on the forestry side, but also on the lands and minerals side, which we'll be talking about here shortly. It's very important.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Epperly, could you just discuss briefly, I realize you were going to probably bring it up today, but our contingency of field foresters, and it doesn't appear that you think that where you are right now is going to affect your goal up there. Where will that affect the Department of Forestry? First of all, you got to tell us if the contingent's down, up, or...
Mr. Epperly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, another great question. We've been managing about 70 vacancies. The most recent early retirement incentive, 26 individuals left the service for early retirement. Some individuals have left to move on to different jobs. And so we've been managing about 70 vacancies from what we were perhaps in the last biennium, which we were short-staffed, if you will, then compared to where we were in 2005. We're down probably in the neighborhood of between 80 and 100 FTEs for the division between where we were in 2005 and where we are today. So it's been significant. One other thing I wanted to point out to give you an idea of how we're managing these funds. If you look at the biennial budget of $170 million this year, or in this biennium, compared to what our average between $135 and $140 million, if you take away the one-time appropriations that we had, which included $36 million for Lessard Sams, $7 million for the Forest Service, the federal legacy dollars, about $2 million for a one-time appropriation from Game and Fish, and a one-time appropriation for general fund dollars to help us manage our timber in this biennium, that totals about $47 million. You take that away from the $170 million, we operated in this biennium around $123 million for the biennium. That we've been managing our costs through unallotments and things like that, basically by managing our vacancies.
Senator Saxon.
So, Mr. Epperly, as a follow-up here, so as I say, it doesn't appear that our timber production is affected. Where are we going to see the most effect for that number of people that were short?
Mr. Epperly.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxog, obviously, when it comes to generating revenue for our timber program, having enough boots in the woods, if you would, to be able to get the timber set up, is where you'll see the greatest effect. But aside from that, we also are concerned about being able to respond to fire, which you didn't see in this report. One of our targets is that we respond to fire within 20 minutes of being notified. With vacancies and things like that, we're going to have to manage that. So all of those we're concerned about and we're trying to manage.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
That's it for my presentation, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Epperle. Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, we're going to now bring up Marty Vadas, who's our Division of Lands and Minerals Director. This is another area that is a huge economic driver in northern Minnesota and throughout the state and the world. So Marty will be touching on some of that and some of the work we do within this division.
Welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Marty Vadas, and I'm the Director of Lands and Minerals for DNR. And Lands and Minerals is responsible for managing the department's real estate portfolio and also managing the state-owned mineral rights. The statutory authorities are and the direction for the work that we do is mainly in the chapters that are listed here. Chapter 84 is for land acquisitions and easements, utility licenses. Chapter 92 deals with state-owned land. Chapter 93 is for mineral land. 94 is lands and state forests. And Chapter 282 is for tax forfeit land sales. Mr. Chair, the budget for lands and minerals is on this slide, and the majority of the funding, about two-thirds, is for PILT, the payment in lieu of taxes. So this is the place in the DNR budget where PILT is located, and the role that we play is that we gather the information from county auditors over the state land holdings in their county and their valuations, and pass that information on to the Department of Revenue along with the funding, and Revenue actually then makes the payment to the counties. The rest of the budget then, as you can see, is for the operation of lands and minerals. And in the past, this was nearly 100% general fund, and today it's closer to about 30% general fund. And over the last 3 or 4 years, there have been other sources of funding, like a portion of mineral royalties pays for our mineral activities now. There's a fee for mine land reclamation. There are now fees for utility licenses. And so there's been a change in the last few years on where the funding comes from to support this program. For real estate management, DNR controls about 5.5 million acres of land, and Lands and Minerals then is the group that does the buying, selling, trading of that land. We also issue leases, licenses, easements on that state-owned DNR-managed land. As I mentioned, we do the payment in lieu of taxes on behalf of the department. We work on DNR land asset management. We have responsibilities for school trust land, and lands and minerals are one historic source of income for the school trust fund. We also manage university trust fund lands in the same fashion. Lands and Minerals is also responsible for a new land record system. This is a project that has been going on for several years now. We're nearing the end of that, and we'll have a new modern land record system for department land that will offer the public access through the web, so where state land is located and what kind of land it is, and even the deeds will be online so people can find that information. And most recently, we also have been responsible for the conservation easements the department has acquired to track them and to work with others in the department to make sure that there's a baseline report on those, and also monitoring those easements to make sure that the easement conditions are complied with.
Excuse me, Senator Saxhog has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Marty, could you give back to fiduciary responsibility for trust lands? Could you give us maybe a little update on our school trust lands that we're trying to make money, if you will, on that are located in the Boundary Waters Canoe area?
Mr. Bates.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhog, You may know that there is something called the Permanent School Trust Fund Advisory Committee, which is made up of some senators and representatives and also some private members. And over the past couple of years, we've been working with that group on a number of items. And one is to renew the effort to remove the 86,000 acres of school trust fund land that are located within the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. And have been working very closely with the U.S. Forest Service to identify some lands to exchange. So in other words, we're looking at some federally owned lands outside of the Boundary Waters that would become school trust land. And we have been fairly successful in identifying some exchange parcels we both agree with. And the idea is that this would be not strictly an exchange. There would be a partial buyout and a partial exchange. And the rough guidelines that we've been given are about two-thirds buyout and one-third exchange. So that means then that we're trying to come up with something just under 30,000 acres that we would exchange, and then we would ask the federal government for payment for the remainder of the lands.
Senator Sexton.
And Mr. Vitas, I thank you for that. And what about some of the school trust lands now that are located in areas where we're contemplating copper nickel? Are there any management challenges there that we're thinking about? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhog, I do have some slides a little later on that talk a bit about what's going on with that. But you are right. There are there's a very high interest in Minnesota for mineral resources that we have that are undeveloped. I think we all know about the iron resource that we have here, but there is a very large deposit of copper, nickel, platinum, and palladium in northeastern Minnesota that has been explored for many years. And it's to the point now where there are companies that are pursuing the development of those deposits. And there are a substantial number of state-owned lands that are part of these deposits that have been identified. And the biggest portion of that would be school trust land that would benefit in the future from royalty income should those deposits move forward and be developed. And it's been somewhat challenging with the environmental review and the permitting process. It's a lengthy process. We're in the middle of that with one deposit called Polymet. And that deposit doesn't have any state-owned mineral rights, but there are four others that do have state-owned mineral rights.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead and continue.
So then moving on then, another responsibility is mineral management. And state of Minnesota owns about 12 million acres of mineral rights, and DNR manages those mineral rights. We try to encourage the development and the environmentally sound development of those lands. And supporting programs then would be things like mineral title research, lease administration, mining engineering, and also a number of different programs trying to look at what the mineral potential is of Minnesota and help identify that.
Mr. Chair, just real briefly in this slide here, it depicts our core library, I believe, up in Hibbing. And I know you're going to be up in the Virginia area next Friday, but if anybody is interested, our core library that we have in Virginia or in Hibbing is world-renowned. And I'm surprised Marty didn't take this opportunity to toot his horn a little bit, but we have people all over the world coming in and looking at these core samples to help with the mineral exploration and determine what is out there. And it's really fascinating to see. So, Marty.
Mr. Chair, I didn't want to toot my horn, but I brought a piece of core. If any of you have not seen a piece of drill core, this is what it looks like. It's cut in half. And it really is, and I have a slide on it on showing what's happening, but it really is the principal way minerals are explored for. And it's really the only way to find out really what's down there. And so a very important part of the exploration in our state.
Thank you, Mr. Baird. We'll pass that around. Senator Gazalka's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, when it's state land Is it public information? What kind of minerals are in those? Is that released to the public? I know private land, if it's they lease it and drill it, they don't like to share that, but I'm just wondering about state land.
Mr. Bates.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, the terms of the state mineral lease is that really for competitive purposes, it's a very, very competitive business, that all the information has to be turned into DNR, but it remains confidential while the lease is in force. If the lease is terminated, then all that information becomes public information and available to everyone. There is also, since 1980 in our state, all of the drill core that's drilled, whether it's on private land or public land, eventually winds up in this drill core library that Commissioner Meyer talked about, and that's also available for anyone to look at. But that's only after the lease terminates. While it's effective, it's confidential information.
Follow up. Mr. Chair, then, Director, if the cores are released and somebody else re-signs a lease, a different company, is the old information available?
Mr. Chair, the answer is yes. The old information is always available. If there's any new information that's generated under that new lease, that would be confidential until that lease is terminated.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Another responsibility for Lands and Minerals is mine land reclamation. We're the ones that have the responsibility, to enforce the state's mine land reclamation laws for taconite, peat, and for non-ferrous. And non-ferrous would be the copper, nickel, platinum type deposits. And currently that affects about 250,000 acres of private and public land. So this law applies to all land in Minnesota, whether it's private or public. And the kinds of programs then that support that are environmental review, and there's another division in DNR that's the lead on this, but we support that program with the people that we have that are familiar with mining. We also do mine permitting. We have the reclamation permit in the state, and it's called the Permit to Mine, and it does cover the reclamation during and after operation closes. We do inspections for compliance for the reclamation rules, and we also have a modest program looking at ways to reduce the environmental impact of mining, and it's a cooperative program where it's some state funding, but also then some private funding to try to reduce those impacts. And then I have three slides that have some of the outcomes and measures for this area. And the first is the state non-ferrous metallic mineral leases that are in effect. And this shows then since 2005 the number of leases and the acres that are under lease. And I think I mentioned we have seen a substantial increase in the interest in Minnesota for mineral exploration and for the undeveloped mineral resources that we have here. The next slide then shows the feet of drill core that have been drilled over the last 10 years or so. And if in 2007 and 8, it was a very active years for drilling. 2009 was a horrible year for the metals business. Really, all sectors felt the same sort of worldwide recession, all metal areas, and drilling was way down. But now in 2010, drilling is back up again. And just to give you an idea, in 2010, there were about 59 miles of that drill core that were drilled in our state in separate individual drill holes doing exploration here. And also on this graph, I have charted the price of copper. That's that squiggly line there. And copper historically has been something under a dollar up until recently. And I think I only have $4 here. Actually, today, copper is closer to $4.30 a pound. And so this exploration activity is likely to continue just because of the demand for those metals. And the last slide I have on the outcomes is the income from mineral leasing over the last 10 years or so. And on the left is the dollar amount. And on the right then would be the state-owned fund. So, for example, the lower one, kind of a green there, is a school trust fund. And university trust fund is that darker blue, and tax forfeit is that lighter blue. And our estimate for this year is it'll again be something over $30 million. And projecting this on into the future, from the estimates that we're getting from, and most of this comes from taconite production, the estimates we're getting from the companies on what they intend to do, this is very likely to be over $40 million in the next several years per year. So a substantial increase in royalty income from this area. And that's the end of my presentation, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Bates.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Now I'll bring up Forrest Bowe, who is the Deputy Director of the Parks and Trails Division. Several years ago, we combined the divisions of parks and trails and waterways together for operational efficiency purposes. We did have some budgetary savings from doing that, but realistically, taking the successful trails and waterway network and making sure that we're promoting and operating them in conjunction with our parks really has been a successful endeavor for us. And the economic engine that our park system is out in greater Minnesota is just, it's a phenomenal experience to see the public-private partnerships that are there. And Forrest is here to talk a little bit about that with us today.
Welcome. Excuse me. Welcome, Mr. Bowe.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Again, for the record, Forrest Bowe, I'm the Deputy Director of the DNR Parks and Trails Division. I wanted to give you a quick overview today consisting of three or four items. One is, again, our statutory authorities, just as the other divisions have. A little bit about our budget. We'll talk about some key strategies and give you a couple of examples of some outcomes, and not going into a lot of detail. Really, in the Parks and Trails Division, we think of having basically three main or core functions. One is to provide a quality system of parks and trails that provide access to the outdoors. And we do that through a system of parks, through a system of state trails, and water access sites across the state. Secondly, one of our core functions is to restore, preserve, and interpret our natural and cultural resources that we have in the states. One of the key things that we do in our state park system. And finally, is to operate and maintain all these facilities and lands that we have throughout the state. Briefly, our statutory authorities, if you look in Chapter 84, and I think it was Mr. Mueller or Mr. Knopf gave the committee an overview. Maybe it's kind of Mr. Knopf, an overview the very first day of your committee hearing. But to refresh your memories briefly, Chapter 84 is where all of our off-highway vehicle programs are found, the ATV program, the off-road vehicle, the off-highway motorcycle, the snowmobile programs are found in Chapter 84. Chapter 85 is really about state parks and rec areas. Talks about specific charges that the park and rec areas have. If you look in Chapter 97, this is where our public water access facilities and statutes are identified in that. So we have 73 state park and rec areas scattered throughout the state. We have 25 legislatively authorized state trails, of which about 21 have some level of development on them. We manage 56 recreation, day use, and camping areas in our state forest. So the recreation part of state forest that you heard Mr. Epperly talk about, we handle the recreation piece. We have 1,600 public water accesses scattered throughout the state, and that, of course, provides access to our waters. We are rated number one per capita for the number of boats we have in Minnesota. So it's a big thing for Minnesotans, their water. One other item, we have 32 water trails covering 4,100 miles of rivers, streams, where we offer canoe and boating routes on those waters. A little bit about our budget and some strategic objectives. Really, three strategic objectives that we try to reach. We strive to connect people to the outdoors. We want to accelerate our management of our natural, cultural, and recreational systems and environments, and we're really trying to invest in partnerships, processes, people, and communities throughout the state. The largest section of our budget is in the Natural Resources Fund. There's many subsets to this fund. These are boating dollars that are money generated from registration of boats and part of the gas tax that's attributed to that. Another subset is ATV funds, off-highway vehicle funds, snowmobile funds are all in those natural resources funds. The general fund is, of course, in this case, about 21% of our budget. We use the general funds for really the maintenance and operation of our state parks. There's only about a little over $1 million that goes to operate and maintain state trails. So if there's something that I would want to point out today to you that maybe you could remember about our budget is that the maintenance and operation of state parks is really based upon the general fund. All the other funding items here, the Parks and Trails Legacy Amendment, of course, added about 18% to our budget. There were three categories, very specific categories that the legacy money was directed for us to use. One was connecting people to natural resources. One was accelerating our resource management efforts on our park and trail lands. And the third was to accelerate rehabilitation of facilities and those kinds of things. And we also have a large grant program that goes to the outstate folks to maintain and operate and develop their local and regional parks and trails of significance. With the strategic objective of connecting people to the outdoors, our division will help people connect with nature and provide those recreational and educational activities that enrich their experiences, their appreciation and understanding, so that they too can become good stewards and understand the importance of Minnesota's resources. Some of the new things that we were able to do this year with mainly the help of the legacy dollars are some new programs I'd just take a quick moment to point out. We tried some I Can Camp programs where we partnered with a local provider to provide the camping equipment and then got people out to enjoy that experience that had never been able to try that before. And people that took part in those kinds of programs were thought it was one of the greatest things, and I think we made some real campers out of people that probably didn't expect they would have so much fun doing those kinds of things. We've tried some archery in the parks. We've tried a variety of things, touch screens. We're going to have one over here in the Capitol here at some point where we just make it much easier for people to access our information, do some trip planning, and once they get to the facility, have many more things for them to do so that they continue to stay engaged. I think what we're finding is, like all of us and you, our time is very valuable, and we want to make sure we've got very fun, exciting, and fruitful things to do when we take part in recreation. With regard to accelerating management of natural, cultural, and recreational environments, we provide, of course, a very diverse system of outdoor recreation, everything from the high-energy motorized type of sports to the very quiet things of birding or snowshoeing and some of those things. So very diverse, trying to reach out to all populations. We want to ensure that all of these things are accessible to all people. We provide some accurate information. We try to make it easy, again, for people to use our parks and trails and our state forests. And finally, we, of course, protect and manage some of the best, some of the rarest, and some of the most significant cultural and natural resources in the state by protecting those areas of state parks. We also invest in partnerships and people and local units of government. We have a variety of programs where we touch local units of government. Some of the grant and aid programs are probably the ones I would point you to and think about. Our cross-country ski grant and aid program, our snowmobile grant and aid program, where we have 22,000 miles of snowmobile trails across the state. We have 150 local units of government that participate in those grant and aid programs, providing about $8 million of money toward those efforts to those local units of government. We have an off-highway vehicle program where we again give grants to the local units of government, and those local units through a club provide trails where people can recreate. The Parks and Trails Legacy grant program this year provided about 60 grants throughout the state. I think some of those were based around parks, some trails, and there was also some energy type grants. Really 60 grants, $8.4 million distributed last year or over the last 2 years with that program. And then a variety of other grant programs using a variety of funding sources. With regard to some priority outcomes, again, there are many. These are just a couple of examples I wanted to point out. And what you can see here is that what we're seeing is that by offering some of these new and exciting programs like the I Can Camp or Geology Day at the State Park, or I Can Rock Climb, making it easy for people to get out, having some kind of scheduled programming, really has increased the number of people that are visiting our state parks. And again, the whole idea is so that people would understand the value and so that they can appreciate and become good stewards of the land as well. Finally, the last outcome that we're measuring is something a little bit different, probably for the Department of Natural Resources. We're trying to measure the number of hits on our website. And we think this is important because this is really where people are now starting to get more and more of their information. They want more information. They want to be able to plan their trip at home. They want to be able to see what that facility looks like. We're offering virtual tours of our state parks. You can click and find and look at a campsite. What's campsite 57 at Itasca State Park look like? What does the lodging at Itasca State Park look like? People want to know what they're getting into, again, so that they're not surprised, so that they can have a quality experience and they can do some planning around all those things. We're also providing some download GPS compatible maps so that you could go to our website, download the snowmobile trails, and have that on your GPS so that you're not getting lost. Again, a part of a kind of a paper reduction piece for us, and offering the know-how behind that as well. So again, compelling people to get outdoors, making it easy, and so that we can have a healthier society.
Thank
you. I think that's it.
Thank you for that report. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
I would have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think this was asked before, just for the information of the committee. Mr. Bo, can you tell me how many parks, and not that it matters, we don't compare ourselves too often with other states, whether it matters or not, but how do we fare out with our neighboring state to the east with regards to state parks? I think that question was asked in committee last year or the year before. As far as numbers, we have 73, you said, now?
Mr. Chair, we have 73 state parks, and I do not know the number of Wisconsin state parks. I do know they have a very nice system, but I do know in many arenas, including the national level, Minnesota is touted as having one of the best state park systems and trail systems in the United States. As a matter of fact, just a couple of short months ago, Minnesota was named the best trail state in the United States.
Wonderful. Great. Can you also tell me, and maybe this is a question for Deputy Myers, but the fee increases, there's a lot of talk of that about the game and fish, but particularly the park fees. When was the last time they were increases? Can you tell the committee that?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I don't know that I can quote the year right offhand, but I believe it was 3 or 4 years ago we raised the fees a couple of dollars and then found out that it was driving some people away, and we actually reduced the fees again. And when I'm talking about the fees, I'm talking about the daily fee. It went up to $7, and now I think it's back down to $5. And I do not recall the last time that we raised the annual fee.
Okay. Just interesting to hear that coming from the roundtable discussion with fees regards to the game and fish. And it isn't just always the ability to raise a fee just because. And then, you know, I mean, there's obviously an outcome for such a move, and obviously you found that out, so you had to reduce it. So good information. Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like for us to step here for a second. We've really been taking a proactive approach, being entrepreneurial and promoting our parks and trails system, doing some partnership with Explore Minnesota Tourism, and also we've had some really successful campaigns with the Minnesota Twins. Break a bat, plant a tree over the summer. Every time a bat was broken, they planted 100 trees, something like that. So we're really looking outside of the box at how can we promote and how can we partner with other businesses throughout the state and other entities to really help people understand the quality of life that we have within our park and trail system. And Forrest, can you just let the folks know, you're going to be getting an invitation February 14th. We're going to have a celebration here in the Rotunda celebrating the rollout of our 10-25-year strategic planning document. And can you just give them a taste of the invitation that they're going to be getting for that event?
Mr. Bo.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The 1025 plan, of course, was part of the legacy outcomes 2 years ago. I instructed the department to do a 10 and 25-year plan for the use of those legacy dollars for the duration. We've worked with the University of Minnesota. They also got some funding to do a piece of that. Worked with them, and so the rollout of that plan, hundreds of public meetings, events throughout the state, reaching out to populations that we hadn't been able to before. We've been able to get about 1,000 college kids to engage in that process. We've gotten to grade schools, junior highs, and high schools to see what younger folks would want us to do with those the legacy funding over the next 25 years. And so really the event on the 14th is really rolling out that plan and then having the legislature make some decisions around how to spend those legacy dollars over the next 25 years.
Good. What was the dates again?
It's February 14th at 10 a.m. in the Rotunda. You'll all be getting a personalized invitation, but I want you to be aware of it right now so you can get it penciled in. It's a culmination of a huge effort that we've taken on with a lot of other people, and it's a great project, and it's really going to help drive where our system's going in the next 25 years in a proactive way. So sorry for putting you on the spot there, folks.
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, the last section we have here is our operations support area within the department. This combines a lot of different activities. It provides the administrative leadership to the department and delivers the services to the public through our regional operations and grant administrations. This budgetary slide is a little bit misleading by showing that it's $55.1 million out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. That's because we're the fiscal agent for those dollars that go through. Not only that, but the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund as well. The legislature cannot appropriate those dollars directly to an entity that's not a governmental unit. So the dollars are appropriated to us. We enter into a grant agreement with a third-party organization, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, whoever it might be, and then we grant those dollars to them following all the state laws and procedures that are there. So the bills that you will be passing into law on the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Parks and Trails Fund, the Clean Water Fund, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, those dollars come to us, and we're the fiscal agent there. So you're going to have to bear with me. It's not $83.5 million for our operational support budget by any means, but the activities that come out of here, you can see special revenue funds, federal funds, general fund, natural resources fund, and game and fish fund are those funding sources that primarily drive these activities. Some of the key things here is to provide, like I said, the leadership and direction for the department, not only here, but also throughout the regions. We have four regional offices: Grand Rapids, Bemidji, New Ulm, and here in St. Paul. to help formulate and establish the policies and procedures, coordinate natural resource management programs and the delivery of the technical assistance and outreach through our regions, coordinate our emergency response assistance and non-fire emergencies, our EOC. When there's an emergency that goes on, we are a big part of the service delivery out there that helps people deal with these issues. We are part of the emergency organization that takes place and making sure the communication, everything goes on, and our enforcement officers and other staff are involved with that as well. I spoke about the pass-through grants and then also the trust fund land management issue, which we'll be spending some time on. The commissioner is the trustee of those lands, so we have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure those lands are generating the highest and most revenue and they're being managed in the appropriate manners, which is a lot of things that we need to talk about. But I know Senator Saxog and Senator Ingebrigtsen, you'll be on that committee now as well. We'll have opportunities to do that into the future. That's the end of this presentation. We'll be spending a lot more time in talking about the DNR and policy bills and budgets. I intend to spend, I don't want to say inordinate amount of time, but a lot of time with you all talking about the budget of the DNR and breaking it down into specific goals and strategic objectives. And the document we're going to use is going to be called Budgeting for Results. It's our form of it's not zero-based budgeting, but it's budgeting on an outcome-based level that we've been working on for the past 4 years, which I think you'll be excited to see. And as I start meeting with you folks one-on-one, I will get you familiarized with that and show you what we have and help orientate you to that. It's quite the document, as we have quite the budget, you'll soon understand. But I think we have to do a good job at showing people what they get for the dollars that are out there and helping you understand what we provide for each dollar that we're appropriated. So.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for that report, and thank you also for offering yourself up to each senator here to go through the budget and the items that are going to be we're going to be talking about here over the next months. So, Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Mr. Meyer, I'm just curious as to in the last few years how many positions are left unfilled in the DNR and/or full time employee cuts to the DNR in the last couple of bienniums?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, I don't have the exact numbers for me. I can prepare a document that will outline that for you. As we've been facing budgetary issues over the past bienniums, we've been dealing with it basically through attrition and other reductions, facilities reductions. We have 180 offices located throughout the state. Where we're located, how we provide energy and cooling to those systems, how we travel, things like that. We've been trying to take savings on the administrative side and keep our conservation and economic driving work at a level that we need to. So we can certainly, I'll get those numbers for you, talk about our complements. They have decreased a little bit. We also have a large temporary workforce, so to speak, seasonal workforce, as you can imagine within the parks and things like that as well, which we can, I'll get a document pulled together.
Thank you.
Senator Kielash, that's a great question, and I think it makes for another great time well spent at an upcoming meeting to see hands-on just exactly how many people over the past, you know, five, 6 years and where we are and where we're going. Because, frankly, when we start talking about budget cuts, it's about people, that's a good question, and we look forward to that.
Mr. Chair, it's also the ability to deliver the services.
That's right. We're all about service. There's no question about that. And so thank you very much for that report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Moving on, next on to the agenda will be Senator Carlson, who will be introducing his first bill and also the first bill for the committee. Welcome to the committee, Senator Carlson. You have before us Senate file number 48. You could introduce who you have with you, and we'll proceed with the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Senator John Carlson from Senate District 4. With me today is Kathy Lewis, the Deputy Assistant Director of Lands and Minerals.
Welcome, Ms. Lewis. Very familiar face, especially when it comes to the lands bill. In the past 4 years, she's been delivering the information and answering the questions. And members, if you have any when we move forward here, she can answer them for you. So please proceed. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate File 48 is the same omnibus lands bill from the 2010 legislative session. Last year, near the end of the session, the lands bill was combined with the game and fish bill. The combined bill then passed in both bodies, but was vetoed due to items that were contained in the game and fish portion of the bill. The lands provision are not controversial and are needed by the DNR, the counties, and the public. The section in the bill that is of most importance for budget reasons is Section 10 of the bill. This section authorizes the DNR to sell certain acquired lands for less than their appraised value in order to meet the budget balancing requirements of the 2005 law that required sale of $6.44 million of state-owned lands by June 30th of 2011. The state agencies have sold about $4.3 million of the state-owned land, leaving a balance of about $2.1 million. The lands may not be sold for less than 75% of their appraised value. When passed, the DNR will hold a land sale within 60 days. The bill also addresses land sales of specific parcels of land for which legislative approval is required. This includes land sales by the counties as well as the DNR. This bill also addresses additions and deletions from state parks and state forest boundaries. The goal here is to pass this bill quickly as introduced so that the DNR and the counties may proceed with the land sales that have been on hold since last May. There will very likely be another lands bill this session, and that would be an appropriate vehicle in which to propose any new procedures, further land sales, or other changes in land management. Again, with me today is Kathy Lewis with the DNR, and she will be able to answer any questions about specific sections of the bill or to go through the bill section by section if you so desire.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Lewis, is that what your desire is, to go through the bill? I think that would be probably pertinent the first time around here for the rest of the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, I certainly will be happy to go through section by section. The first section of the bill is regarding the trout stream easement formula. One of the items that the DNR acquires for our acquisition program is trout streams, and rather than using an appraisal, we're allowed to use a formula. And what this is technically is a change that allows us to recognize the changes that the Department of Revenue made in their table that they use for the calculation. So it's a technical change. Section 2 of the bill is a very technical change. It just is recognizing in the statute that McCarthy Beach State Park lies in both Itasca and St. Louis counties. Section 3 is also ended up being basically a technical change. It was modified from language that was originally introduced, and what it does now provide is that the DNR may acquire lands adjacent to a state forest, and then we would return to the legislature for a boundary change for the state forest. Section 4 is also a technical change, clarifying that state forest lands may be acquired subject to or not subject to mineral reservations.
Sure. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you. Just one question on that. I just want to confirm that means that you could buy the land even if the private owner reserved mineral rights. Is that what that is?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is correct. Section 5 of the bill is a provision that removes the requirement that riparian state-owned land only be exchanged for other riparian land when the exchange is to remove the state-owned land from the BWCAW. Senator Saxhawk already brought up this issue today, and this is to facilitate a value. It still will be a value-for-value exchange, but it removes the requirement that you have riparian for riparian in those cases. Section 6 of the bill is starting our boundary changes. Section 6 has boundary changes for four state parks, adding areas to the state park. And what it does is it changes the boundary of the state park. It's not an appropriation for purchasing the property. It's just the boundary change. Section 7 is deletion of areas from state park boundaries. A good portion of these are small parcels, and there's some tax forfeited land involved. Section 8 is expanding the boundary of Lyon State Forest by 640 acres. This is already state-owned land, it's school trust land, and it's bringing the land within the boundaries of the state forest. Section 9 is providing that there's going to be compensation for the purchase of tax forfeited land that's being included within the Split Rock Lighthouse State Park under the Section 6 of the bill, and that acquisition is in process and has is nearing completion at this point. Section 10 of the bill has been discussed by Senator Carlson. It's the budget balancing provision of the bill. And then Sections 11 to 42 are the land sale portions of the bill, and it has sections of land dealing with DNR land sales, and there's 295 acres involved. And also what happens with these land bills every year is there's separate bills introduced by legislators for the counties, and there's tax forfeited land sale parcels, and they are added to the DNR bill. And so what you actually see before you is a compilation of about 20 bills during the session last year that have been added to the bill. And then the last in the last section of the bill, of Section 43 in Winona County, there's a Rushford Area Drainage and Conservancy District that was abolished in 1987, but the lands were still owned by the Drainage District. And the Attorney General's Office advised us that while those lands are owned by the state, but which state agency administers them is not clear in law, and go to the legislature and make it clear in law which agency should administer those. And so we discussed that with other agencies, and the DNR has been identified. And finally, we're asking that it be the land sale portions be effective the day following final enactment so that we can proceed with the land sales and address the needs and issues that have been arisen through the counties and through the DNR. That's a quick summary, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know who to address it to, but Section 10 about the 75% of the value for the sale, looking at the language, and I'm wondering if it is clear enough to say specifically that these sale provisions are only to meet the requirements of the 2005 bill? Or did you assume this to be for other land somewhere going into the future once we have met the requirements of the 2005 bill? I don't think you want to, but...
Mr. Chair, Senator, the language here is only to meet the requirements of the 2005 legislation as it was amended in 2007 and 2009. Because the original requirement was not met by the agencies, the legislatures have extended the law over the period of years. The current sunset date is June 30th of 2011, and if that budget amount is not met by that date, the deficit is taken out of the state agency budgets. Also, I would mention that in 2009, the legislature passed a law that said, as of the effective date of that law, any land that was in the outdoor recreation system cannot be sold to meet the requirements of the budget balancing law. So that means if it's within a state forest or a state wildlife management area, et cetera, as of May 8th, 2009, we cannot sell that to meet the budget balancing requirement. So that limits the pool of lands available for the DNR to sell in order to meet the requirement. But we did have lands available for sale that had been removed from outdoor recreation status before that law passed, and we still have them available over the counter. And we hope by providing a little incentive that this would provide an opportunity to raise the amount of money that the legislature has asked us to raise.
Ms. Lewis, if I may, you stated it was June, the effective date expires on June 30, 2011. It's 2012, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the 2005 law, which was amended in 2007 and 2009, does expire, says the sales have to occur by June 30th of 2011. That is the current status of the law. The revenue could still be coming in. We have about 90 days to pay, so the revenue could still be coming in after June 30th. But the sales have to occur by June 30th, 2011.
Thank you. Any other questions? The committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, now when we're changing the statutory boundaries of the state parks, within the statutory boundaries, there's a lot of private land, as I understand. How does this affect that versus land owned by the state? I'm a little unclear about
that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, for the properties involved, if you change the boundary and it's a privately owned parcel, it does not affect the private owner. What it does do is gives us the opportunity when the landowner is willing, and we only buy from willing sellers, that we have the opportunity to proceed to purchase the property. Under the statutes, we cannot use state park funding to buy property that's not within a state park. There's one other exception for facilities adjacent to a state park. So for Forestville Mystery Cave State Park, that is a private piece of property, but we are currently in negotiations with the owner looking at it. The Judge Magny State Park is a private parcel. The Split Rock parcel is a tax forfeited parcels that we're in discussions with currently with the county and close to completion. And the Teteguch State Park is a private parcel. But the private parties have to decide that they want to sell to us.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm wondering how this affects what you want to sell, not what you want to buy.
Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Section 6 would not affect that. Section 7 does not affect what we want to sell. This bill has two provisions. It's got land sales in here, but it's also a boundary bill change. So it's regarded as omnibus lands bill, so it addresses different types of issues.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, I need to provide some clarification on a section in the bill. It's Section 10, found on page 7, 7.19 to 7.27. This is a provision that was in the bill last year that we were working with Senator Lurie on and the city of Cloquet. This land that's identified here is our forestry office in the city of Cloquet. Is that Section 10? I'm sorry, it's Section 13.
Section 13.
I was on the wrong page. Section 13 on page 10, 10.25. This land is located in Carlton County. The city of Cloquet is interested in acquiring this piece of property at some point in time, no point in time soon. There was some interest in putting a big box retail store kind of right adjacent to where our property was, and they needed our property as well. We're still willing to work with them on it, but in order for us to sell this area, we need to figure out where we're going to move to. This location is used to house a lot of our forest firefighting equipment and also staff and personnel there. So we're willing to work with the city and relocate, but we don't know where we're going to go to. The fiscal note identifies that this would be about $1 million of revenue that would be deposited in the facilities management account to be used to help us locate and rebuild a new office site. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. We decided in speaking with Senator Lurie and Representative Hilty and others that we would keep it in the bill to give us that flexibility should we come to the point in time where this property is again part of a piece that they need to put together for a bigger economic development site there. But I wanted to make sure people understand we aren't looking to sell this right now. We're just looking to maintain or receive the authority to sell it to you can see it's to a political subdivision, but it's not going to be happening within the next year or 2 years or sometime like that. So it's identified in the fiscal note. I wanted to clarify that issue for the purposes of that as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I'm just kind of curious. Mr. Meyer, what happens to a piece of property to make it become surplus or unwanted or unneeded in your collection of properties. You know, I can understand kind of, you know, the boundary changes in a state park. If, you know, I saw that Split Rock, we're adding 40 acres and or adding 80 acres and deleting 40 acres, and I assume they're not the same acres. But kind of what goes on in your thought process about deciding that something is now surplus or unwanted or unnecessary land?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, there's a lot of different thought processes that take place to make up that decision depending on the parcel of property. In this case, it's to meet the needs of that local jurisdiction or that city. We can be located relatively close to the highway in a number of different areas, but to meet their needs for our good neighbors, we can do it, look at it that way. With the office sites that we have throughout the state, and I'll be showing you a map at some point in time where all of our locations are, it's how can we operate the best, most efficiently, effectively, and economically that may or may not put a piece of property up for surplus. And then once we do that, there's a procedure that we need to go through that offers that piece of land up for sale to the university and schools and local units of government before it would actually be put on the block. We worked with Senator Scully last year on a piece of property in Roy Lake, a station that was there, another forest station that we had firefighting equipment at, to transfer that to another local unit of government. And we're going to maintain our presence at the facility, but it drives down our costs and maintenance and operational costs into the future. So we're looking at our locations, where we are and how we operate on a continuous basis that may bring up a piece of property to be surplus. If it's not being servicing its immediate needs or the needs of that it was acquired for, can also bring it up to that level. So we're managing and looking at our land as an asset and trying to evaluate the best needs of the state and where we should and shouldn't be through all sorts of different processes. I know that's not a very complete answer, but we can spend more time talking about that in detail if you would like, Senator.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Myers. You mentioned the Roy Lake Station. There are a couple of land sale provisions that aren't in here. One was the Roy Lake Station. One was a Senator Olson provision. Just for the record, those two provisions have been resolved through commissioner's orders?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, yes. We were able to do several things of that nature administratively. The one in your district, working with Senator Olson, making sure the city of Wayzata was able to receive a piece of land to do a roadway improvement. And I'll turn to Ms. Lewis and see if there were any others that we were able to deal with administratively or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, the Roy Lake Station has been sold to the, and also the city of Wayzata parcel were sold, so they were completed transactions. And we had previous legislation, and then they were sold under the intent of the legislature of what the value was.
Thank you very
much. So they've
been
completed.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyer, then what makes the difference in the buying and selling that you can do by commissioner's order and which then has to be done through statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, those weren't done through commissioner's order. Those were done under previous authority that we had in legislation that was passed. Okay. This bill is made up of pieces of land that have shoreline, riparian lands that need legislative approval, or are trust fund lands that need to have legislative approval, or are directed sales where the state would be selling to a person who inadvertently built a garage or a building on a piece of land, a trespass issue, things of that nature. It's in the county pieces, the tax forfeited pieces that need legislative approval as well. We can maybe the best thing to do before the next bill would be get you a fact sheet on land selling authorities and how those procedures work.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyer, you used to do a lot of that, those fact sheets that made it so I didn't have to ask all these questions. Thank you. That'd be good.
We have one that we handed out in this, but not to that level that you're asking for, madam.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Any other questions, concerns? Senator Carlson, your wishes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 48 be recommended to pass.
Members, the senator is moving Senate File 48. Any other discussion? Senator Bechtel.
And referred
to the floor.
To the floor?
Directly to
Very
the floor,
good.
Yeah. Any other questions?
We
any other discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
And that concludes the committee for the day.